Disclaimer, the views and opinions you hear on this show are not the opinions of AnimeNewsNetwork.com.
From Los Angeles, I'm Justin Savakis.
And I'm Zach Birchie. Welcome to ANCAST. How's it going, Justin? You were absent last week.
Yeah. It was, I didn't really have anything to contribute to that conversation.
Right.
I'm so into cosplay, as you know. but yeah, it's been a weird week. I got my debit card number stolen.
Fun.
And yeah, I had to track down $300 in fraudulent charges.
Nice.
Most of which from Habbo.com.
Which makes me laugh that it's Habbo Hotel.
Well, you know, clearly I'm a regular. You know, I spend my time, you know, picking up the teens.
Right.
Now, Habbo.com, I called them, and the woman I spoke to on the phone, she was very nice, and they refunded my money, of course, but they made it very clear that this is their day.
Really?
Apparently, and this has been happening to a lot of people I know, where their credit card or debit card number gets stolen, and there's like a dollar ping charge on PayPal just to see if the card works.
Right.
And then like some online something or other, usually some online community where real currency is transferred into fake online currency.
Right.
Is basically used to launder money. And according to the woman at Habbo, it's... a lot of it's based around China, and they've kind of given up hope of finding any of these people. It's just really kind of a bad situation. It reminds me a lot of, you know how Right Stuff, when people order from overseas, they insist that you send in a scan of your passport.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Huh. And international customers just hate it.
Right.
And, of course, they're just like, why the hell do you need all this? This is why. You know, Sean told me point blank, you know, he has been scammed so many times that it's just not worth the trouble to ship overseas unless, you know, they're willing to bend over backwards for it.
Wow. I didn't realize that, like, scamming was that huge a thing. Like, I had no idea it was that big of a problem.
Well, this is actually the second time it's happened to me in 3 months. Like, Citibank keeps sending me new cards. And thank God they're actually pretty good customer service-wise, because, you know, they're pretty good about advancing you the provisional credit, because last time it was $600, and it was, that time it was a bunch of random restaurants and gas stations in Brazil.
Yeah. Now, the only time I've only had my credit card number stolen once, and somebody just bought a bunch of crap off of Amazon, but, I mean, I had, like, $200 in my bank account at the time, so they weren't getting very far, you know. So, since there's nothing new, we're kind of two-thirds of the way through the winter season, and things are kind of dead. We reached into the vault, or rather, you reached into your vault. And
right.
So what we did wind up watching was Lupin the Third's Greatest Capers, which is this old streamlined tape of, like, 45 minutes worth of Lupin
episodes. There are two episodes, I think, from the first Lupin series.
Right. Now, these are the ones that Miyazaki directed, right?
Yeah. And you can totally tell.
Yeah. Well, were these the only episodes he ever directed?
No. I think he was series director, but I think these are the two that he actually, like, did himself.
Yeah.
Usually episode directors and series directors.
Yeah. I was laughing because it's, like, if you told me, like, hey, Miyazaki totally directed two episodes of the old Lupin TV series, like, this is what I would think it would be like. It's kind of like if Steven Spielberg directed in his early days, like, a Three's Company, and in the episode there was a giant shark on the Holocaust. Like, this is like, oh, no, you don't say Miyazaki directed these, because...
Yeah, Fujiko looks exactly like a Miyazaki woman.
Yeah.
Like, seriously.
And most of the episode is her kicking ass, like, which is not usually what happens in a Lupin episode.
There's a lot of aerial fighting, and the airship from Nazca makes an appearance.
Right.
as does the Lapta robots.
Yeah, I guess, like, at the time, he was just given a chance to finally use some of these concepts and ideas he had and just sort of threw them into this episode. But it feels kind of, I hate to say hacky, but a little hacky. Like, he didn't have that many ideas when he was younger, and he just kept using these same concepts.
It's Lupin. I mean, the whole idea is a little hacky. Here's a very episodic show of a thief and the wacky adventures he gets into with his buddies.
Right. So you can pretty much do whatever you want.
Right. And, you know, as a result, the sort of latitude and grind that an anime TV series kind of makes it so these auteur directors use it as a testing ground for the ideas they've had rattling around. I mean, look at Paranoia Agent.
Yeah.
Paranoia Agent has a whole bunch of interesting ideas that are clearly not fully fleshed out that would later be repurposed in a much better form in Paprika.
Mm. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, and that's kind of what this is. It's Paranoia Agent is to Paprika as these are to later Miyazaki.
Well, actually, early Miyazaki. All of his first couple of films are...
By later, I mean later.
Yeah, all this stuff is all in his stuff from the 80s. But yeah, it was interesting to see. But what it got me thinking about was the fact that Lupin, they've tried, what, 4 or 5 times to make it popular here? And it just... No one... Americans just have no interest in it.
Right. Let's see. Streamline tried it. Animego tried it. Manga UK tried it. And actually, there's one Lupin movie, Mystery of Mamo, that has 4 different dubs. and then finally, Pioneer tried it. Tried to bring out the series from the 70s, which clearly there was going to be an interest in.
I guess the thinking was like, oh, people will think this is cool because it's retro and it's like 70s hip and like, but no, it's just old.
The thing is, 70s anime looks like 70s anime, you know, with the 2 frames a second animation, if you're lucky, and you know, the simple blobby characters, and it's not attractive. Like, kids that are into anime, even of our generation, are into it for the aesthetic, and it wasn't fully developed at that point.
No, but the fact of the matter is there were newer Lupin series that they eventually did bring out, but even those, just not successful. Like, I don't know what it is about Lupin that just never hit.
It's similar to all of the thief that you root for type things with really episodic stories. It's just kind of incompatible with I think, modern storytelling expectations. Like Cat's Eye is another example.
Yeah.
Where it's just... kind of, it feels very... The whole setup is very cheesy.
I guess that's true. Like, I guess I'm a sort of an example of somebody who just never connected with the property, because every time I'm watching something that's... Every Lupin thing I've ever seen, except with the exception of Cagliostro, I'm sitting there going, uh-huh, okay, it's Lupin. Like,
right.
I don't even care to finish the film, because I know what's going to happen. The characters are all going to do what they do in every single Lupin thing. And I, you know, I'm sure there are people out there who just love it and have seen every single episode and every single movie. Some of those movies are fucking dire. Like, they're really bad.
Yeah, I recently sat through Bye Bye Liberty Crisis, which is quite possibly one of the worst pieces of animation I've ever seen. It's a TV special that basically involves the Statue of Liberty being stolen and visiting every possible known to mainstream Japanese American landmark in the process. While Lupin is kind of half-heartedly searching for the mother of this annoying genius kid.
Oh my god, that sounds bad.
Oh, it is. not to mention the whole Statue of Liberty thing is already resolved by the halfway mark.
Really?
Yeah, it's really horribly paced. The ending is kind of meaningless and weird. There's a whole thing with computer viruses, but the whole thing is the, like, rattling reel-to-reel tape decks 1970s idea of computers. It's a train wreck. It is a complete and utter train wreck, which is kind of a shock, because it was actually by a decent director, Osamu Dezaki.
Well, they pump those things out once a year, right? There had to be one a year.
And there are good ones, and there are horrendous ones.
The worst one I saw was Fujiko's Bad Day.
I heard that was a train wreck.
Yeah, well, once you get to the werewolf on the submarine, it's...
What?
I barely remember that movie, but it was absolutely fucking just dire. Like, really, really, really bad. But the thing is that there... And the I guess the testament to the fact that it never really picked up is that not a lot of those movies got fan-subbed. Circulated. The ones that were out were like Cagliostro.
Right. Which is clearly the best.
Yeah. Isn't there like Dead or Alive was one that
Dead or Alive was one that got fan subbed. I know Mamo has been, well, Animego put out those on VHS really early in the VHS era. So those got seen a lot.
Right.
But yeah, it's been really spotty what's been fan subbed, and a lot of the fans just haven't bothered with the bad ones.
Yeah, well, and with good cause, that's sort of a utilitarian franchise. It's kind of like, so I guess wondering why it never really hit in the States is kind of like wondering why a mediocre, not to say that Lupin is mediocre.
It's a lot
just,
of it is.
A lot of it is, and it's just sort of television product for Japan. So I guess it's kind of like asking, like, well, why isn't this, you know, sort of B-level sitcom really popular in Japan?
Yeah, why didn't Home Improvement hit?
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that's probably a good a good way to put it. So, yeah, well, if people were wondering,
it doesn't aspire to be high art, and you can really tell because everything else Monkey Punch has ever created has been utter shit.
What else has he done?
Well, there was that wonderful, God, what's it called? Oh, yes, Gundo Musashi.
Oh, yeah, that's infamous.
Which was known for looking like Chinamation.
Which is weaving the nation.
It was actually a huge hit on DVD in Japan because Otaku bought it ironically.
Yeah, I remember that. That was like a big, like, ironically loved show. Like, people were just waiting for the next horrible animation mistake or whatever.
Right, and then there was a short-lived, like, little OAV that came out in the 80s called, it was about reporters, I'm Scoopers, that was it.
Never heard of it? I'll stay away.
No one even bothered fans on it.
Great. Okay, so one thing that I kind of wanted to get into is everybody always wants to know numbers. Everybody always wants to know, like, oh, how many units did this sell, how many units, that's almost because these are closely guarded secrets that are not released to the fans.
Right.
But armchair quarterbacks, that's total catnip for them. Now, we do video streaming. And we actually can, like, say, like, what's been working video streaming and what hasn't been working video streaming.
Right.
Not to mention, Crunchyroll just released this iPhone app, and you noticed something very particular about this app.
I'm not sure if it's on the iPhone app, but it's on the Boxy app.
It's also on the iPhone app. I've noticed people saying that it is.
But. Oh, cool. Well, on the Boxy app, they have a list of, they call it their top titles.
Yeah.
But most people, when they release their top titles, they cut off the list at some point, and they just don't just list everything in the order of popularity.
Right.
So we can see exactly rank-wise where everything is. Their top title, of course, is Naruto Shippuden.
Shocker!
Yeah, nobody saw that one coming. what I don't think anybody saw coming was our big, big title last month was Zeta Gundam.
Right.
Which is a mecha show from 1985.
Is that our biggest success streaming-wise?
Second biggest.
Second. What's the biggest?
Oran.
Oran High School, Okay.
Yeah.
Now, how does it break down dub versus sub? What does better?
Well, there's frankly not enough dub being shown.
To really?
There's the odd show where we get both. Mm-hmm. And in cases such as that, it can go one way or the other depending on how hardcore otaku the show is.
Right.
So for a show like, say, Save Me Lollipop, where it's probably, if you're going to watch it, you're probably going to be a dub fan.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the dub does better on that one.
Right.
Something more otaku, like a Gundam, just by virtue of being subtitled, a show will do a lot better.
Right.
So it really, there is no a good predictor of which will do better on streaming.
Yeah, because looking at the Crunchyroll list, and the Crunchyroll list, their hits are Naruto, Skip Beat, you said,
Shugachara. Mostly shoujo stuff.
Mostly, yeah, a lot of the shoujo stuff. And then the bottom of the list is stuff like Cobra and
the really manly stuff.
Yeah, and Cat Blue Dynamite and
<Well.
laughs> pre-World War II anime. The bottom of the list is pretty, I mean, it's not surprising that what's at the bottom of the list is at the bottom of the list.
Right. Gundam didn't do well for them, though. It did much better for us than it did them.
Yeah, well, I don't...
We have a nerdier fan base, I guess.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Crunchyroll is strong with the teen crowd, and we get the people who obsess about everything the industry does.
Yeah, that's true. But it sounds like even taking the Crunchyroll list, which is a definitive, here's what's popular, here's what's not, and then you have knowledge of what's working for us and what's not working for us, it sounds like it's just so scattershot that there's no way to predict what's going to work on streaming and what isn't.
Yeah, we can easily predict Naruto's going to be the number one thing on Crunchyroll. We can easily say that highly popular, probably the most popular show in the Gundam franchise is going to do well for us. The stuff that just does good, not the great ones, the good ones, that I don't know even where to begin as to predicting what's going to do well there. Like, for example, one thing that started off mediocre, but just was consistently a huge show for us just over a period of months, Girls High.
What?
Yeah. I mean, like, who would have predicted that? Same thing with Heroic Age. And for Crunchyroll, the number two shows, Shugachara, and then Skip Beat and La Cora Doro, those are shows that probably anybody in the DVD market would have turned down.
Yeah, most likely, yeah.
So, I wonder if we're seeing a big demographic shift, like, you know, seemingly the female side of the market was never all that into buying DVDs. They were more into manga, but maybe they'll watch it more casually online.
Well, so just to wrap up here, the shows that are really at the bottom of the Crunchyroll list are, I'm personally a little satisfied to see some of these down here, like Asura Crying.
Yeah.
Because I hate that show. I want it to go away.
Kasad Mom's Life, obviously no one was really going to be all that into that show. Same with Aaron, which is kind of a shame because that show is actually good.
It's supposed to be. I haven't seen it. I have not seen that show.
And Charger Girl Juden-chan, I heard basically Crunchyroll, their fans, either you want that show uncut or you don't want it at all.
Yeah, it's, yeah.
And
there's no point in a censored version of it.
Yeah, and I think the younger demographic that likes Crunchyroll is probably a little more disturbed that that stuff even exists.
Yeah, more than likely. It's kind of weird to see some of their simulcasts down here. Like, Hanamaru Kindergarten is down at the bottom, and that's currently airing. So, some of these, like, that are at the bottom of this list, they've been around forever. There's no new episodes.
Yeah,
it's
like
no
the
wonder.
Old Toei stuff, like Fist of the North Star.
Yeah, like, it's no wonder because there's nothing new. But something like Hanamaru Kindergarten at being at the bottom or near the bottom, well, you know, that's got to be disappointment for them.
Yeah, and, you know, Crunchyroll, they have to pay to subtitle a lot of this stuff themselves.
Yeah.
So I'm... Maybe some of this stuff, you know, isn't worth bringing over, but I don't think anyone is very good at telling right now what is and what isn't, because the patterns that we're seeing viewership-wise online are completely different from the patterns with DVD.
Yeah, wow. So it's a giant mystery. The world of streaming remains a big question mark.
We're still learning.
Yeah.
It's early yet.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and bring the guest in. All right, we're back. Our guest today is publishing director at Yen Press, Kurt Hassler. Hi, Kurt. Thanks for being on the show.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Sure thing. So tell us, you have a long history in publishing. Could you give us sort of a brief rundown of how you got started and how you got to where you are now?
Sure. If you want to go back to how I got started, my first job was in a Doubleday bookstore in Manhattan right after I graduated high school. From there, I got a job at an independent bookstore while I was in college, sort of worked my way up to becoming the buyer there. Then after I graduated college, I went to work for Borders Group and became the graphic novel buyer there, amongst other categories. And in November of 2006, I helped to found Yen Press with Hachette Book Group.
I didn't even know Doubleday had a retailer.
Yeah.
It was a long time ago.
At one point you were named the most powerful man in manga. When was that and how, I mean, did you agree with that at the time?
I think that was actually the month before I ended up leaving Borders.
Right.
And it was a poll done among people in the industry, so I really didn't know anything about it until after the fact.
Right.
I mean, it was definitely a great honor. Certainly nice to be able to add something like that to a resume.
Right.
Definitely in the position that I had at the time, I was very influential in the manga industry. I had contacts with all of the major publishers. I was pretty regularly consulted on everything from titles people were looking to acquire to price points, you know, the frequency of releases. So it was a great position, and I sort of got to dabble in a little bit of everything.
So back then, just to compare, like, 2006 to, say, 2010, and I know your job has changed, but what was the retail market like when you were doing the buying for Borders versus what is it like out there now?
Well, I mean, in about 99, 2000, it's when we first really started experimenting with manga in the traditional bookstore market. Mm-hmm. Probably Sailor Moon was the first book. You know, followed in short order by things like Cardcaptor Sakura, Dragon Ball, and it was just explosive growth. I mean, it was a tiny, tiny category when I started buying it, and by the time I left, it was one of the biggest genre categories in the market.
Mm-hmm.
It's a much tougher environment in 2010 than it was in 2006. You're talking about, you know, in those 6-7 years, you went to seeing absolutely explosive growth in manga, you know, triple-digit percentage growth year on year. And in the last couple of years, we've actually seen some declines in the manga market in North America.
Do you think it was an issue of just saturation?
Some of it was saturation. I think a lot of it has to do with issues we're still facing, particularly with scanlation. I think that's probably the single biggest issue that, you know, publishers really need to address at the moment.
Now, that's recent, because as recently as like, say, 2007, whenever I would talk to anyone in the manga business, they would sort of dismiss scanlations. It's like, well, no one likes reading books on their computer. It's just not that big of a deal. But I guess now it's as bad as it, and I've heard people say this before, now scanlations are being attributed with as much damage as, like, fan subs were to the anime market. I mean, it sounds like you would agree with that, that it's that big of a problem.
I would absolutely agree with that. And I think, to some extent, you know, and bearing in mind that I wasn't a publisher back then and really didn't have to interact with scanlations in the same way.
Yeah.
But, you know, you recognize that it came out of a group of really dedicated fans. And, you know, to some extent, I think that among a lot of publishers, there's been this sense that you don't want to dampen the enthusiasm. But at the same time, you're taking material that these people don't have the rights to, putting it up online, which means hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people have access to it. No one's given the rights. The creators have no say in how their work is being handled. And it's directly competitive with the publishing industry. You're talking about, if you type in just about any manga that you might go looking for, the first sites that are going to come up are not the people who have the legal rights to these properties, but something saying, you know, read such and such for free online.
I was just going to ask if anything was, anybody's attempted to do anything about that.
Well, there have been sporadic attempts here and there, certainly. Some people have had some success with, you know, certain cease and desist orders. Some sites are better about complying those with than with others are, but I think that every publisher is really looking for a much more aggressive stance on this, because it's something that the industry just can't afford to turn a blind eye to anymore.
Right. So do you think what titles do scanlations impact the most? I would imagine that the scanlations for something like a Naruto or a Bleach or even like a Soul Eater, it doesn't, I mean, I don't know, that you tell me, like, does it really impact the big titles, or is this really hurting the smaller titles?
I think it's hurting everything across the board. I mean, you just can't have a situation where somebody is taking something, you know, and putting it up for free and saying, here's an alternative to actually paying for it. Because right. At the end of the day, that's really what's happening. When you talk about trying to quantify exactly what impact it has on a title-by-title per basis, it's almost impossible to do something like that. But right. Certainly when you look at the industry trends in the last few years, and particularly with respect to how they sort of match up to the rise of the scanlation aggregators. There's an almost perfectly negative symmetry to the trends.
Right. Wow. Okay, well, message for everybody, stop with the scanlations, I guess.
Well, so it sounds like this didn't really become a problem until there were, like, websites, you know, kind of similar to how Crunchyroll was in the old days for anime, before they went legit, where people can just casually look at it rather than downloading torrents or something.
Well, I mean, the funny thing is, when you go onto some of the sites and you look through some of the comments being made, a lot of the people don't even realize that these books are available in print.
Yeesh.
You know, they just find them. And it's, the scanlation trends have changed so much. You know, it used to be, well, it used to be scanlations. You know, it used to be people getting the Japanese raw, again, which they don't have any more rights or access to. Mm-hmm. You know, just because it's not available in English doesn't mean you get to sort of co-opt the creator's rights and go put it out there for to be available in English by yourself. You know, you don't have free reign to do that. The copyrights do apply. But now what you see is not even somebody going to the extent of, getting the Japanese material and cleaning it and translating it, now you see the actual North American publishers' books just being scanned and uploaded to these aggregator sites.
God, that's pretty bad.
That's exactly what happened with anime.
Yeah, that is exactly what happened with anime. Okay, well, that ugliness aside, let's talk about
to get the ugly topics out of the way first.
Let's talk about Yen Press. Now, Justin and I both went out and picked up a copy of Yen Plus, your anthology magazine, to do quote unquote research for this, and we both took a look at it. And starting out with Yen Plus, what is the strategy behind Yen Plus?
Really from day one, it's been a marketing vehicle. We wanted to have some way to get people more familiar with the titles that we're looking to publish as trade paperback collections somewhere down the road. And the really nice thing about a magazine is you can expose people to multiple titles. Even if there's just one title that they're really hooked on in the magazine, it gives them an opportunity to read things that they might not otherwise read. So if somebody is a fan of Soul Eater, then they get to see Korean material that they might never have heard of. Or if somebody's a Maximum Ride fan, they may be exposed to Japanese manga for the first time. So, it's a way to cross-pollinate the reading in a unique way that's difficult to achieve in a different format.
Who would you say the audience is? Because that's what we were trying to figure out. It's kind of tough to figure out who is this for.
Shoujo mixed in with American stuff, mixed in with Soul Eater.
Yeah.
Well, and that's exactly what we wanted to do, because the market in the U.S. is much, much smaller than the market you see in the Japanese market or the Korean market, where they can, almost afford to be more specialized in targeting their audiences. When you compare a market that size and as developed as that market is, and try to replicate the same thing in a much smaller market, your numbers become much more difficult to achieve.
Right.
If you cast a wider net and try to reach out to somebody who's an enthusiast for the medium, then you're potentially getting a lot more eyes on it, and it becomes a better marketing tool. And that was the goal that we had.
So it sounds like this is less of an attempt to compete with Shonen Jump and more just a way getting your titles out there.
No. It is Shonen Jump's a great model. But Shonen Jump's built on, the most successful model in the Japanese market with access to that content. We really had to take a different approach and sit down and figure out what we wanted to achieve. And the goal, again, was to make something that wasn't, limiting the demographics that we were targeting, that was, out there to expose people to a wider selection and sort of give them a broader view of what's available in the market. And again, to reach as many eyes as possible.
At the same time, I imagine there are fewer logistics involved in making your own magazine as there are anglicizing an outside magazine.
Yes, definitely. There are definitely. Well, and there are advantages again, because, that ability to have original books that we're developing side by side with established titles in Japan, to throw Korean titles that aren't necessarily as well known, but there's just some brilliant work in there. It's a great mixture, and it really accomplishes a lot.
Right. So the other obvious strategy that we sort of saw here was the big push for creating manga versions of your popular book series. So like a Maximum Ride or like a Gossip Girl, which is in Yen Plus. And briefly, I just want to say, was there any hesitation that putting Gossip Girl in Yen Plus would turn away a sizable portion of the male audience?
No, there really wasn't. I mean, again, because we always approached it with that the more people you can expose to the medium, the better. We absolutely knew that title wasn't going to be to the tastes of somebody who's maybe a Soul Eater fan.
Yeah.
But the intention is not for it to be a magazine where every title is tailored to one taste. It's to sort of broaden the palette a little bit. So, no, there was no hesitation about it whatsoever. And again, if you can take some of that fan base, that may not be familiar with manga that's a huge fan of Gossip Girl, and if just a handful of those people pick it up and are exposed to manga and become new readers and find other titles, it's only a good thing for the industry.
Yeah, I've personally found it extremely amusing, being familiar with the show Gossip Girl and then reading the manga version of it, how like one-to-one mirror match it is. Like, oh, Gossip Girl is just a shoujo manga. Like, it really is.
Well, and that's it's funny because we get a lot of questions about, oh, you're doing this with your titles, you know, you're taking things like A Maximum Ride, which has a huge fan base, and why are you doing it as manga? Well, I mean, again, if you look at the models in Japan, the whole idea of taking light novel material that later becomes a manga, it's a given. If there's an audience for it, it's sort of the natural transition to make a manga adaptation of it.
Right.
So we're just applying some of the same logic that's going on in the other market, but doing it with domestic properties.
Right, right. So Yen Press's overall strategy, like everything you've got out there on the shelves, what's working for you guys?
I mean, we've got a lot of great successes lately. Certainly the Square Enix titles that we're publishing are doing gangbusters. Haruhi has been doing phenomenally. Maximum Ride, you know, one of those adaptations, is hands down our best seller. I think that you know, the two volumes just spent something like 15 weeks each on the New York Times bestseller list through the holidays.
Wow.
So we've got a ton of successes out there. You know, we relaunched Yotsubato. That's been doing, you know, again, gangbusters numbers. We've got Spice and Wolf coming up. We've got Kobato coming up. So we've got just huge properties. And, you know, we're thrilled with how well we've been doing in this tough market.
How tough is the shelf space shrinking at all? Are the retailers harder to get through to? I mean, I imagine you have a much better, easier time communicating with, say, Borders than a lot of other people do. But how tough is it to get your books on the shelves?
It's really about building up the retailer's confidence in your list. We sort of launched Yen Press walking against the hurricane winds of the markets going down, and we really had to prove ourselves in that tough environment and demonstrate, you know what, you're not taking a big risk when you're trying out a yen title. And the retailers have really responded to the performance they're seeing. Just by virtue of the sales being down, the retailers are being more cautious. But again, that's where it's having that reputation and having that track record of success that they can point to. It becomes much easier to say, you know what, this is a title. You may not know it very well, but this is worth your time, this is worth your investment, and we've had a great track record of being able to point to those sure things, and it's really established Yen Press as a force to be reckoned with in the market.
I would imagine that announcing that you're doing a manga version of something that's already a best-selling property, like Maximum Ride, the retailers immediately jump on that. Like, I would imagine it's a no-brainer for them to pick that up.
You know, it is and it isn't, because there have been some that have been successful and some that are not, but, you know, with Maximum Ride having been the first one we've done, and, you know, a real benchmark for success, it becomes much, much easier. And it is nice to have a name like James Patterson, something that is a proven success story to them. It's a lot easier to say, here's a manga adaptation of a James Patterson property that you've already sold, you know, 3 million copies of, versus a title that they've never heard of and have a difficult time pronouncing, which may have just, you know, just as much opportunity for success. But it's a much longer conversation.
Now that you just described Tokyo Pop's entire remaining catalog. So let's talk about Twilight. Now, this is obviously I would imagine that this is for you guys what Dragon Ball is for Funimation. Would that be an apt? Because the minute the pre-orders became available for that, it immediately became like the number 4 or 5 best-selling thing on Amazon.
Absolutely.
So you guys must be really excited about this giant torrent of cash that's going to come your way.
we're excited about the property in general. I mean, having seen the finished product, having watched it develop, it's just a gorgeous, gorgeous book. And having it be tied to something that is so successful and does have such a rabidly dedicated fan base is gratifying in the extreme. And we're extremely lucky to be associated with that property.
Right. So how did, I mean, obviously the decision to do that was a no-brainer, but are you, I mean, there's got to be a concern because the fan base is so rabid that they're going to be disappointed or let down by whatever the finished product is because it's not exactly like the book or whatever they had in their head. I mean, I would imagine this property was handled with extreme care, right?
Extreme care would be putting it mildly, but at the same time, when we're talking about being worried about letting down the fan base, Stephanie Meyer was so, so involved with this from day one. You know, it's got her complete stamp of approval. The goal with it was really to capture her vision of the property. And in doing that, you know, it really alleviates any fears about letting down the fan base because she is the ultimate authority on the work. And, you know, we went through a long time trying to find the right artist, trying to get the right style, and when she saw it, it clicked, and it all just fell into place from there.
Right. It seems like such an obvious thing to do, just like, oh, of course, let's do this. What was the timing like? Because you're coming in a little bit late with this. The third movie is coming out this year, and once that last movie is out, I think that's pretty much it for that franchise. So was there an attempt to get this out a little earlier, like maybe before the second film?
Well, I mean, really, it's not being driven by the film at all, because the books were a massive international success that really drove the success of the film. And this is not based on the film. This is based on the success of the novels and, you know, Stephanie's original vision of the work. So the films really aren't a driving factor in it and never have been, because the film wouldn't be the success it was without the books. So
yeah,
we're
true.
Really basing it on that foundation.
At the same time, you're clearly going to reap major rewards from the massive, massive marketing campaign that Summit will surely, you know.
Yeah, that's what I was referring to, is in terms of this being part of the giant hype tornado that generates billions in cash, like, the placement and timing of this, there has to be some kind of a strategy there, like, okay, now's the time to put this out.
Really, no. I mean, when we were setting Yen Press up, you know, I had a list of titles, and, you know, that were from our parent company, and Twilight was right at the top of that list, so it was something we were focused on from day one, but it wasn't a sense that we were rushing to a finish line to try and capitalize on the film marketing going on behind it. It was really, we need to focus on the needs of the book and the needs of the work and make it as good as it can be. The timing that it is really fortuitous for us,
yeah.
But it wasn't something where we were ever running to the finish line. You know, if we could have gotten it out sooner, we probably would have, but, you know, we would never have rushed something like this. It was really about, again, finding that right artist, giving her the time to do her work and to do it as beautifully as she's doing it. So all of those are just sort of almost like background noise to really focusing in on the property itself.
Right. Okay. Interesting. So when you're personally, like, how much of the licensing, like, when you're just deciding, like, what properties you're going to pick up, how much of that is all you?
Well, at the end of the day, I'm the final word on all of it.
Right.
I'm involved with every property that we've licensed, but our editorial staff is definitely involved. Our senior editor, you know, is always sort of my right-hand man when it comes to bouncing an idea off of her, getting her take. You know, our assistant editor, Tanya, you know, certainly has those titles that she advocates for. Our editorial assistant, Abby, has titles she advocates for. So it's a very collaborative effort in that way. But at the same time, the final word is really coming down from me.
So then what do you look for in a title? What do you generally gravitate towards?
You know, I gravitate not toward particular genres. I sort of gravitate towards the individual works themselves. Obviously, if something is doing great in Japan, it's something we're going to be more focused on. But just having a bestseller in Japan doesn't necessarily equate to a bestseller in this market. So a lot of it's understanding the consumers here, knowing what they're waiting for, knowing what they're sort of primed and eager to get on the shelves. That's definitely a piece of it. But then there are other titles where we're not necessarily just focused on, is this going to be a bestseller, but is this an interesting book in and of its own right? Do we think we could find a new audience with this? Probably the best example of that on our list is With the Light.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah, so one other thing you've been experimenting with lately is the light novel market, actually translating light novels and bringing them out here as paperbacks. First with Haruhi and now with Spice and Wolf. Other manga publishers have dabbled in this too, both Viz and Tokyopop notably. How's it doing for you?
We've been actually really pleased with how it's been doing. Haruhi was the first one we published with our sister company, Little Brown Books for Young Readers. It's defied our expectations. It's actually done better than we had hoped it would do, which is great to see in a tough market for light novels in the U.S. You know, I know that Kadokawa has been very happy with how it's performed. We're seeing similar results with Spice and Wolf right now. So on a whole, in a tough environment, we're pleased with the numbers we're seeing.
And speaking of Spice and Wolf, how long did it take you to get really sick and tired of people complaining about the changes you made to the cover?
Well, that's one we knew was coming. It wasn't exactly a big secret that we were going to make some people angry. But I think we laid out the reasoning behind it, and it goes back to what a tough environment it's been for light novels in the U.S. Putting these books out with covers designed to appeal strictly to a manga enthusiast or an otaku has not worked, and the retailers recognize that. And they will be the first ones to tell you that if this is the presentation you're bringing me, we're not going to put this on the shelves. And based on the performance they've seen, I can't necessarily argue with them. If I'd been in the same position, I probably would have made the same call. So it becomes, for the purposes of giving the book the exposure it needs, do you risk alienating a piece of the fan base that you know desperately wants it and will support it? Or do you put the book out and hope they understand the business reason behind doing that and recognize that at the end of the day, you're really working for the benefit of the property, even if somebody doesn't necessarily agree with that direction?
So then, is the ideal situation to get these light novels into the young adult section rather than in the manga section?
It's not necessarily the young adult section, the fantasy section. The ideal situation is to get them in front of potential readers who may not be manga enthusiasts.
Right.
And that's not to say that ultimately the decision of where something goes is ours. You know, it's really the retailer's decision as to where they think they're going to have the most success with the title. So we will get a lot of criticism when we change a cover like we did with Spice and Wolf, and then people go into their local bookstore and they see, oh, well, it went into the manga section anyway, so what was the point? Well, just because it is in your store or in a particular group of stores doesn't mean that's the way it is everywhere, and it doesn't change the reality that we are being told something very specific from the key retailers who are bringing in these products, and that's not something we can ignore. If we did, the books wouldn't be on the shelves at all, and nobody would get to read them.
Well, yeah, except for the crappy fan translations. Hey, you should have pitched Borders on putting Spice and Wolf in the economics section.
I think that would have been a tough sell out of that section.
Okay, well, before we got some Twitter questions for you here, but before we go, before we get to that, the obvious question that I have to ask you, and I think you deserve this question at this point, Team Edward or Team Jacob, Kurt?
I'd have to go Team Edward. They've got a picture of me in the shirt around the office, so I don't think I could make any other claim.
Oh, God. Okay, yeah. Okay.
So happy I don't work in that office right now.
Well, actually, before that, what do you personally like? What are some of your favorites?
From our list?
Well, from anywhere.
You know, it's funny because I'm sort of in the enviable position of being able to decide which books I want to work on.
Right.
So, You know, Higurashi is, you know, I'm absolutely nuts for the title. I can never wait until the new one comes in. I am absolutely in love with the Spice and Wolf novels. I just finished my editorial pass on the third one the other day, and I can't wait to get that out there. Always reading Haruhi when it comes through. Absolutely dying for the first Bungaku Shoujo novel to come out. I don't think it's necessarily as well known as it should be. And you know, having read the first one now, it was great. It was absolutely fantastic. Soul Eater is a huge favorite of mine. In fact, I was just watching the Funimation version the other day, finished up the first season. I have pretty diverse tastes, but yeah, that's the nice thing about the job is you get to experiment a lot.
Any books from another publisher that you wish you could have gotten?
Full Metal Alchemist, hence. We were a little late to the game on that.
Right.
One,
yeah.
You know, really, when it comes to the new titles coming out, we've just had great success in getting the good properties, you know, coming down the pike. Kobato's poised for May. We're expecting great things out of that. Black Butler, you know, was just a massive success. It's been on the New York Times bestseller list since it released, so I can't make any complaints that way.
Cool. Okay. All right. So Twitter. It's from Swan Jun. Some of Yen's Sun Yang, I think I'm pronouncing that right, Sun Yang manhwa has ended or will be ending soon. Cynical Orange, you're so cool. And the recent licenses were more manga-oriented. Can we hope for more of the Sun Yang manhwa series to come? And they'd love to see DVD rescued? I don't know what that means.
Well, DVD's been out. I don't see us, you know, going back and republishing that. But, you know, we're always looking at it. Our senior editor is a huge advocate for those titles, so I could definitely see more in the pipeline.
From Ed Sizemore, who you probably know, are they going to publish all the Sundome books?
Yes, we are.
Okay. Well, there you go, Ed. And he wants to know if you're considering rescuing the Crest of the Stars light novels.
We get so many rescue requests. Yeah. I really get the sense that people think we're just out there trolling for properties that are in the water somewhere.
Through the dumpster, yeah.
You know, no, that's not one that we're currently looking at. You know, we really don't do a lot of titles where we're going back and trying to figure out what we can rescue from other publishers. Mm-hmm. Where there's an obvious one, like Yotsubato or Azumanga, we're thrilled to be able to do it. But, you know, we're really focused on what are those new licenses coming down the road that, you know, we can make serious proposals for.
Okay. Well, he also asked about the Captain Tyler novels. I would imagine your response would be the same.
Also not something that's on the radar at the moment, I'm afraid.
Okay, and the most over-asked question, the preview of the Twilight manga that was in Entertainment Weekly, what was up with the lettering? Is that
was up with the lettering?
Yeah, that's what they want to know. They want to know if it was rushed out because the lettering was off. I didn't see it myself, so I don't know what they're talking about.
No, that is the lettering from the book. It definitely wasn't rushed. If I had to guess, what they're referring to is that it's not a common comics font that was being used.
Right.
But that was a very deliberate decision based on the particular property we were working with.
Right.
We actually spent weeks in the office reviewing our font options, and we really wanted something that was simple and elegant. And at the end of the day, we were surprised to find that Times New Roman really fit the bill and the tone of the book better than anything else we'd been looking at. And rather than make a decision based on, well, that's not a comics font, we went with what the needs of the book were, and we think it looks gorgeous.
Okay, well, there you go, everybody. all right. Also from Ed Sizemore, what did you think of the reaction to your criticism of Kate Dacey's review?
Pig Bride review?
Yeah, he's referring to... I guess you had a harsh reaction. So our listeners know what this is. Can you sort of explain what happened here?
Yeah, basically there was a list that was put out last year, and I forget exactly what it was titled, but it was... something like worst manga of 2009 list.
Ooh.
And I had been surprised to see a title of ours, Pig Bride, on that list. The reviewer made some criticisms basically intimating that the author was a misogynist, and I didn't agree with that, so I posted a rebuttal on the Yen site. Now, to answer the question as to the reaction to it, I really didn't get a big negative reaction to it. Yeah. We had a lot of people saying that they agreed, that they loved the title. Just to clarify, my big complaint was not that, you know, the person didn't like the title. I wasn't a big fan of, you know, throwing the charge of misogyny against an author. I think it's a little unfair to try and interpret what an author's intentions or personal tastes are based on what's being read in literature. So that was the crux of my rebuttal to the article. So I guess that's about it. I don't know if that answered the question or not.
I think people are not used to a publisher defending their titles. I think people aren't used to that. Viz is so corporate and so quiet that...
this was something where, you know, and there was sort of a back and forth with the person who wrote the article. And it was really more of a literary argument where I coming from education-wise, being an English and a comparative literature major, I just sort of have this personal negative reaction to throwing a charge like that out against an author, particularly when I don't personally think that it's justified. Mm-hmm. So it was more of, more of a institutionalized argument, if you will, in that respect. And it wasn't really an argument. I just didn't happen to agree with it. But, you know, if something else came up and I felt, you know, passionately enough about it, I'm sure I would do the same thing.
Right. Okay, well, that makes sense. From Invalid Name, who's buying With the Light? Is it manga fans or families of autistic children?
I think we are seeing a bit of both, and I certainly hope that more families with autistic children get tuned into the title, because certainly the letters that we've gotten from those readers have been very moving, and it's great to see. And I think that it was a huge loss when the mangaka passed away a few weeks back, and we were very quick to express our condolences to Akita Shoten. I know that title is really precious to them, and, you know, we're very proud to have been able to publish it.
Yeah, our boss, Chris McDonald, is actually a big fan of that title. I keep meaning to check it out myself.
If the listeners haven't read it, I highly suggest it, because it is one of the most moving manga you will read, I think.
Actually, that brings me to one question that I did want to ask. Now, Viz has been moving into publishing a lot of more sort of literary stuff, more adult stuff, more... Mm-hmm. things aimed at an older audience. And I'm very appreciative of that, because that's the kind of stuff that I personally want to read. You know, stuff like Pluto and all the Sig Geeky titles and stuff like that. You guys looking at any of that stuff, moving into that area?
Yeah, I mean, if there are opportunities to do it, I don't think we would do it to the extent of sort of creating a sub-imprint for it. But again, we really don't try to restrict ourselves in the types of material that we publish, and want to stay open to, you know, something new and something different. And if there was one in particular that caught our eye, or one of the editors wanted to advocate for, we would absolutely give it serious consideration.
Cool. Have you considered any of the, because they do a lot of really expensive, like prestige format publishing, you know, mm-hmm. hardcovers with slip cases and stuff like that. Has that ever shown itself to be worth the cost?
Again, I think it's a project by project basis. You know, if you think that there's a title that really benefits from it, I think that can be very successful. But I think you have to sort of place your bets as to where you go into that kind of publishing. If you know you can hit a very, very dedicated fan base that's going to appreciate it, then I think absolutely it's well worth doing.
Okay, and finally from Danielle Hayden, she asks, my question is regarding manga and e-readers. With the rise of smartphones like the iPhone and the increasing popularity of e-readers like the Kindle, does Yen Press have any plans to distribute on these platforms?
It's definitely something we are actively exploring. A lot of it has to do with finding the right people to work with and making sure that the material is being well represented. The e-ink is a little bit tougher because of moiré issues, mm-hmm. where the screen tones get muddied and come out as really odd and unattractive patterns.
Yeah.
Certainly the iPad, you know, given the type of screen it is and the graphics capability, that becomes a much more attractive possibility for it. It's definitely something we're looking into. It's something that every U.S. publisher, I think, wants to do. What people don't necessarily understand is the intricacies of trying to obtain those rights from the licensors, who are hesitant for a variety of reasons,
and how completely
not the least of which being
yeah.
going back to that whole scanlation problem.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. She also asks any possibilities for an app in the App Store or in the Android market, and do you have any idea what kind of a price point you'd put on a digital copy of a manga?
I think there's definitely the possibility of it. We don't have any concrete plans at the moment. It's something we would love to be able to do. We are talking to some people about testing a few things out. It becomes easier when we're looking at the original materials where we already control the digital rights. So we will probably be testing something. Price point wise, we have to get a little further down that road to try and figure out what the appropriate price point for that would be.
Cool. All right, man. Well, before we...
You sound exhausted.
No. It's just that there's so much to go over, and things keep popping into my head.
You're our first manga-related guest.
Yeah.
Manga industry guest, that is.
Yeah, so this is all fresh for us.
okay.
Do you have anything coming up that you just want to plug?
Well, I think I plugged Bungaka Shoujo. We made some new announcements recently. I think everybody should definitely keep an eye out for K-On! Later this year. We're hugely excited about that title, and we've got some new announcements for next year that I think are going to make some people very, very happy, coming up probably around San Diego Comic-Con.
Of course, right. that always makes sense. Okay, well, thanks a lot. That was very informative for us, and thanks for coming on the show, man.
It was absolutely my pleasure. I appreciate the offer.
Okay.
All right, guys, that's our show for this week. I want to thank Kurt for coming on and chatting with us today. Don't forget to subscribe to ANCAST on iTunes, and we'll see you all next week.